This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Tom Clancy, Power and Empire by Mark Cameron. Read for you by Scott Brick. Prologue. A dozen men clad in bright orange coveralls and white hard hats swarmed the decks of CGSL Orion, the 396-meter flagship of China Global Shipping Lines, like ants. The hollow thud of metal box against metal box rattled the air, adding a bass note to the scream of gears and the whine of spinning cable drums. Gargantuan orange gantry cranes towering 50 meters above dipped and rose, then dipped again, their noses swinging back and forth from dock to ship, with payloads of white, green, blue, or red metal containers, known as TEUs, or 20-foot equivalent units. Gao Qian, chief of the ants, stood on the concrete docks of Dalian. This was one of the busiest container hubs in China, and the mountain of TEUs stacked beside the huge vessel made the man look and feel minuscule. He waved his good arm and spoke into the radio clipped to a loop on the chest of his coveralls. The broad smile across his face belied the frenetic pace of the activity around him. Far too busy with their own tasks, none of the other dock workers looked up to pay any attention to his flailing arm, but they listened intently to his voice over their respective radios. His job was to coordinate and make certain the loading went quickly and safely. Of all the people on the docks, Gao was intimately familiar with the dangers. Each year, almost 750 million of these ubiquitous metal containers, roughly 24 trillion pounds of cargo, moved around the world via tractor-trailer, locomotive, and cargo ship. Roughly 180 million TEUs came from China, and well over 10 million of those came through the port of Dalian, on ships much like Orion. The job of a dock worker was stressful enough, but Gao Qian found it difficult to concentrate, considering his recent upturn of fortune. Gao was 41 years old, with thinning black hair and a round face that naturally relaxed into a smile. A co-worker had remarked that he always looked as though he'd just relieved himself in the swimming pool. He was not a big man, nor was he particularly strong. In truth, Gao had many reasons to be unhappy. His right hand had been crushed in an accident 3 years earlier, when a turnbuckle on a piece of lashing gear had snapped. The sudden loss of tension allowed the TEU to shift just a few inches. But those few inches were enough. 3 fingers of his right hand had been sacrificed to the ship, his bone and flesh smeared between the steel bulkhead and the 50,000-pound metal box like so much red currant jelly. Gao's thumb and remaining finger were of little use. He could at least hook the antenna of his radio and depress the talk button, allowing him to direct the activity of the crane operators and the dozen orange-clad stevedores, ensuring that the stacks of TEUs were loaded correctly and efficiently. Gao earned no more pay as the chief coordinator, but given his useless hand, he counted himself lucky that the dock manager gave him a job at all. And besides, it made sense that the men who did the hardest and most dangerous work received a few more yuan a day than someone who merely stood on the dock and talked into his radio. Other men in the crew might eventually move up and become true supervisors with offices of their own, but that was not to be for Gao. In all his years, he had never strayed farther than 100 kilometers from his birthplace of Dalian, and then only to visit his wife's mother, who lived on a small piece of cooperative land north of the city. He'd grown content enough with his lot, and then the man with the red eye had come to visit him. 3 weeks ago, the man had offered a considerable sum of money to see that a certain TEU was loaded into a certain spot aboard a certain ship. To Gao's astonishment, this arrangement happened twice more, and each time the man had given him an envelope of money along with verbal instructions. He made Gao repeat the number of the desired TEU and would not allow him to write it down. Today, the man with the red eye wanted 2 TEUs, PBCU-112128-1 and PBCU-112128-2 loaded together, well aft of the stacks, low and near the center line of the ship. CGSL Orion was classified as an ultra-large container vessel, or ULCV. Almost 400 meters in length and with a draft of 16 meters, the ship was deep enough to stack 18 TEUs from the bottom of the hold to the topmost box above deck. 23 TEUs could be arranged side by side across her 53-meter beam. One TEU looked much like any other, so the chalky blue box with unobtrusive white X's painted at each corner would soon blend with the 16,000 other boxes aboard the ship, all similarly muted in color, that were stacked over, under, and around it. PBCU-112128-1 and PBCU-112128-2 were not particularly difficult to remember, which was a good thing, because Gao was already thinking of how he was going to spend the extra money the man with the red eye had given him. 900 yuan, roughly equivalent to $150 US, each time he helped arrange a spot for a container that was going on the ship anyway. It was a tidy sum for someone making 7,000 yuan per month. Gao suspected his benefactor worked for a triad and wanted his container of drugs or other illicit material stowed deep in the middle of the thousands of containers on the vessel, thus lessening the possibility of search by authorities. Gao was a moral man, opposed to narcotics. But 900 yuan was 900 yuan, and he rationalized that he did not know with any degree of certainty what was in the container. The man with the red eye had assured him that he wanted only to hasten the unloading process when his container reached its destination. So Gao took the man at his word and kept the money, with a conscience as cloudy as his benefactor's eye. He was able to slightly assuage his guilt by thinking about how he might spend the newest installment of 900 yuan. Keeping well clear of the swinging cables and flying TEUs, Gao followed the man's instructions and located PBCU-112128-1 and PBCU-112128-2 in the stacks. He located the barcode on each container and checked them with the scanner he kept secured to a lanyard at his waist. He then coordinated between the operator of the second gantry crane and the stevedores working aft of Orion's exhaust stack and bridge house to guide the chalky blue TEUs into place. The entire process, from the time Gao first pressed the talk key on his radio with his surviving finger, to the moment the locking cams on the lashing hardware were turned at each corner of the two containers, locking them together, 7 layers from the bottom deck, 10 rows aft of the raised white bridge castle, and 11 across from the starboard rail, took just under 6 minutes. His task complete, Gao began to move his arm again. He spoke into the radio, directing the crane operators and stevedores as they continued to fill Orion, none the wiser to his deal with the red-eyed man. The chief of the ants smiled, 900 yuan richer, and thought about the pigs he could now purchase for his mother-in-law. He liked his mother-in-law. She was a good and gentle woman, well-deserving of some new pigs. Hands clasped behind the small of his back, General Xu Jinlong of the Central Security Bureau leaned in to peer through the tripod-mounted camera over the rooftops of the Chunhe residential district and industrial buildings situated along the port of Dalian. A soldier at the core, Xu was thick across the shoulders, with the big hands and muscular forearms of a man who spent more time in the field than the office. Two other men flanked him, one close and relaxed, ready to take orders or give counsel. The other, a youthful man wearing a pair of black sunglasses, had positioned himself back a few steps. His hands were folded in front of him, his head slightly bowed as he waited to be bidden forward. All three men stood in the shade of a small copse of walnut trees on a gravel apron off Zhongnan Road, just north of Haijiun Park and Laohutan Scenic Area. Many varieties of protected birds and plant life were abundant in these woods, so passers-by paid little attention to the powerful 800mm telephoto lens that protruded like a cannon from the front of the digital camera. The camera itself was superfluous. It was only there to give the lens credibility. The last thing the general wanted was a digital record of any of his activities. He had not come to capture the beauty of Laohutan's numerous waterfalls or magnificent root carvings. His interest at the moment lay northward, down the hill toward the sea, and the intense activity along the Dalian docks. Charged with protecting the highest political leaders in China, the duties of the Central Security Bureau were akin to those of the U.S. Secret Service. Operatives in the CSB, however, put much more emphasis on the word secret, particularly those operatives under the command of General Xu. Xu stood motionless, eye to the camera, studying the scene with rapt concentration. The dark suit the 56-year-old man customarily wore allowed him to blend in among the hordes of similarly dressed businessmen and government officials around his offices in central Beijing. But Beijing was 460 kilometers away, and a suit would have drawn unwanted attention as he stood on the side of the roadway on the coast of the Yellow Sea. He dressed instead in light khaki slacks and a white shirt with the sleeves rolled up against the unseasonably hot and muggy September. A beige photographer's vest of lightweight nylon hid the Taurus semi-automatic pistol tucked inside the waist of the khakis. The men with him were similarly dressed. But the young CSB operative named Tan wore dark glasses to cover a severely bloodshot eye. All three men were tall and fit, as those tasked with the protection of other men needed to be. Both the general and his protege, a man named Long Yun, had come up through the officers' corps of the People's Liberation Army, long following Xu by a decade. Another 10 years younger than Long, Tan began his professional life in the People's Armed Police. He'd shown great promise until the blood vessels around the pupil of his right eye began to burst every time he sneezed. Rigorous testing revealed his vision was still fine, but Xu found the thing hideous and looked for assignments that would keep the man out of his line of sight. It was the general who had suggested Tan wear dark glasses, even on cloudy days or indoors. It would not do to have the general secretary or some other party dignitary thinking one of the men who protected him was half blind or, worse yet, half drunk. Xu used a handkerchief to wipe the sweat from a high forehead. He spoke without looking up from the camera. "Comrade Tan, do you trust this crippled dock worker of yours?" Tan's shoes crunched in the gravel as he took a half-step forward. "I do, General," he said. "I have conducted 3 transactions in all, 1 week apart. In the first 2, I chose a container at random, each from a lot heading to the United States. Over this 3-week span, Gao Qian has mentioned our arrangement to no one, not even his wife." "Astounding," Xu said, and gasped mockingly, though he doubted that Tan had caught the inflection. What man in his right mind would confide a sudden windfall of money to his wife of all people? General Xu stood up from the tripod, arching his back, feeling it pop and snap. In retrospect, it was a mistake to use someone from his own staff for the negotiations, but he would never admit it out loud. The matter of the container ship Orion had been conceived and decided prior to his arrangement with the man known as Coronet. Other operations would be far more tidy, and less likely to connect to Xu or his organization. "The gods gave men mouths," the general said, "and in my experience, men have a difficult time knowing when to keep those mouths shut. This endeavor must be handled with the utmost discretion and secrecy. We cannot afford for your man to speak of this. Ever." He looked at Tan. "Do you understand?" "Of course," the younger man said, but Xu doubted this was true. "You must kill him," the general clarified. Tan blanched at the order, proving Xu's suspicions correct. "Of course," the young man said again. "Today," Xu added. It was tedious how everything had to be spelled out for this one. Tan braced to attention and gave a curt nod. "Of course," he said again, stammering, as if any more appropriate words had flown from his brain. The general sighed, exhausted by the conversation. He tipped his head toward the tripod. "Retrieve the lens and gear," he said, "but be certain you are careful as you put it away. The people's money should not be wasted by shoddy handling of equipment." Before Tan had a chance to repeat himself yet again, Shu turned to Long Yun and gave a knowing glance toward the car. Long Yun settled in behind the wheel as the general took his customary spot in the back seat on the right side, so the two men could more easily communicate. Outside, Tan blustered on the gravel pad as he packed the camera equipment, no doubt made more nervous by his boss's watchful eye through the tinted window. "Follow this witless egg," Shu instructed Long Yun. "When he has killed the cripple, silence him as well. I am afraid your man Tan lacks the constitution for matters of delicacy and discretion. If the fool on the docks has not yet bragged to his friends, then someone will most certainly have witnessed him meeting a man with such a hideous eye. That ship will reach the United States in 2 weeks. I'm confident there will not be much left after the incident. But the Americans are known to be extremely thorough. There can be absolutely nothing to link Orion to this office. Do I make myself clear?" Long Yun turned and grinned at the general. "Of course," he said. Chapter 1 Jack Ryan Jr. sat behind the wheel of a dusty Ford Taurus and rubbed a hand through his dark brown beard, trying not to think about his growing need to pee. The car sat parked for the fourth time in 7 hours, and Ryan rested both hands on the steering wheel, staring into the darkness. Dallas, Texas had a reputation for being muggy, even in fall, but this September night had turned out cool, allowing the two men in the Taurus to keep their windows rolled up most of the way and the AC turned off. Just 2 years old, the dented Ford looked to be in much worse shape than it actually was. The Taurus was one of the few models that could be a police car or, with a quick coat of rattle-can black and some judiciously applied dents to the doors and fenders, become a ratty beater that those same police would see as a meth fleet vehicle. Despite being in dependable shape mechanically, this particular car stank like bad cheese and dirty gym socks, blending well into this seedy South Dallas neighborhood. A quick internet search had revealed that the intersection not 3 blocks away was among the top 5 most likely spots in Dallas to get stabbed. There'd been no stabbings tonight, as far as Ryan knew, but the night was still young. The sound of bottles breaking on pavement not too far down the street signaled that a cutting, at the very least, was a distinct possibility. Ryan tapped the steering wheel with his thumbs and looked at his watch. His need for relief was going to reach critical mass in the next few minutes. He had a Gatorade bottle in the back seat, stashed there for surveillance emergencies, but he really hoped to get out and stretch his legs for a minute, even if it was behind a stinking dumpster that overflowed with pizza boxes in an alley littered with broken syringes and used condoms. During the 42 minutes they'd been parked between the back door of a Mexican grocery and a store that sold sewing machines, of all things, Jack had seen a half dozen guys, all Asian, go into the Casita Roja strip club across the street. Over the course of those same 42 minutes, he'd watched a homeless dude stagger by and vomit all over himself, a graffiti artist tag the back of the sewing machine shop, and 2 hookers entertain clients as they stood against the rough brick wall beside the dumpster, accompanied by a halo of moths fluttering under the sad glow of a feeble street lamp. "If you could see me now, mother dear," Ryan mumbled to himself, tapping the Taurus's armrest. "You say something?" Bartosz Midas Jankowski asked from the passenger seat. Like Jack, he was bearded and wore a loose button-down shirt with short sleeves to cover the Smith & Wesson M&P shield pistol tucked inside his waistband, as well as the loop of copper wire he wore low around his neck. Hollywood would have everyone believe the entire communication package, including the mic and radio, could be wrapped up and fit into the tiny bit of plastic worn inside the ear. Ryan wished it were that simple. There were tiny mics, but they still required a radio and some kind of power source. Campus members used a Profilo wire near-field neck loop mic and a small flesh-tone earpiece. A house-built voice-activated intercom system obviated the use of a PTT switch. The whole shebang ran off a Motorola radio about the size of a fat deck of playing cards. "Just thinking about this sexy life of a spy," Ryan said. "I'm gonna need to take a leak in a few." Four other sets of ears listened to the conversation over the encrypted net. Ryan had hoped Midas might admit he needed a relief break as well, to make him feel a little more human in his time of need. No such luck. Jankowski was relatively new to the campus, but Jack had been on enough ops with the retired Delta Force commander to know he possessed a bladder the size of a watermelon. "I went an hour ago." Domingo Ding Chavez's voice came over Jack's earpiece, gloating a little, "when I slapped the microphone up." Chavez, a senior member of the campus and a former CIA officer, had made an educated guess about their target's next stop and arrived in just enough time to stick a magnetic high-gain microphone to the light fixture outside the doors of the Casita Roja. About the size of a matchbox, the little mic broadcast on the scrambled radio frequency of the team's net. It was surprising what useful intelligence could be picked up from people just before they walked through the door of an unfamiliar location. Even when alone, they sometimes just blurted out things to themselves. Chavez continued to rub it in. "I had me a few sips of a cold one while I was inside. Had to blend in, you know, go with the flow." He made no comment about the nude girls gyrating on the stage. His father-in-law, the campus's director of operations, John Clark, a legend in the intelligence community, happened to be working overwatch on this op from the roof of a payday loan place halfway up the block, with a good view of both the front door of Casita Roja and Ryan's Taurus. He was listening on the same net. Ryan sighed. "Maybe I should go in and try to get a listen on what our guy's talking about." "Negative," Clark said. "We have the tracker on his car and we're up on his phone. Right now, we're just building patterns." Chavez spoke through a barely concealed chuckle. "Mano, a white guy like you would stand out in there." Ding had a master's degree in international relations, but he could turn on his East L.A. accent at the drop of a hat. "Hold up," Clark said. As the boss, his radio was primary and had the ability to override any chatter, which he frequently did. "Two Asian males coming out the main entrance now." Jack threw his own monocular scope to his eye and got a good look at the two men. In their early 20s, with short cropped hair, both wore faded jeans. Loose white wife-beater shirts displayed arms and shoulders covered with tattoos. They loitered by the doors, each lighting up a cigarette. Ryan could make out the print of a pistol stuffed down the front of one guy's jeans, barely hidden under his shirt. The team had already identified several members of the Sun Yion Triad. Casita Roja was a strip club run by Tres Equis, a small cell of the Sinaloa cartel known for the three figurative X's formed by a single bullet hole between the two dead eyes of their victims. Since the capture of Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, factions of the cartel were becoming even more bloody, if more violence than that brought on by the Sinaloa was even possible. It made sense that everyone in the club would be packing. The men out front spoke in rapid Mandarin, which to Ryan made them sound highly pissed about something. Midas cocked his head to one side, listening. The Chinese men took a couple cursory looks up and down the street, saw nothing to alarm them, and settled in to smoke and joke. They finished their cigarettes, stood outside, and then talked for two more minutes before going back inside, as if on a time clock. "I'm guessing those two were triad," Ryan said. Midas gave a slow nod. "Sounds like these Sun Yion assholes are into some heavy shit with Tres Equis. Prostitution, drugs, you name it. According to these guys, they're supplying the Mexicans precursor chemicals to cook up some meth. My Mandarin's a little rusty, but I'm pretty sure I heard red phosphorus in there. Clark concurred. Thought I caught that. He wasn't fluent in Mandarin, but he'd been around long enough to pick up more than a few words and suss out the interspersed English. Any mention of Eddie Feng? Nope, Midas said. Their target, Eddie Feng, was a Taiwanese national. Apart from being addicted to strip clubs and lap dancers, he called himself a reporter for a rag called Zhenhua Ribao, True Word Daily. This online journal specialized in juicy exposés about the secret lives of the political elite in the People's Republic of China. The ZRB was, at best, sensationalized clickbait. At worst, it was just plain fake news. Jerry Hendley, CEO of Hendley Associates, the financial arbitrage firm and white side face of the campus's clandestine activity, would never have approved the unwarranted surveillance of a bona fide journalist. But Eddie Feng was more of an entertainer and propagandist. Feng did, however, appear to have stumbled on something going on with Taiwanese operatives and the PRC. Jack had found the tenuous connection while comparing some chatter on an internet forum for the Confucius Institute at the University of Maryland. According to several U of M students, True Word Daily had run an article about the bombing of an unfinished subway tunnel on the outskirts of Beijing. There was a lot of detail in the article, at least the translation Jack read, details only someone familiar with the investigation, or the person or group who did the bombing, would know. Ryan happened to be privy to the same information in the form of a People's Armed Police transmission grab by Fort Meade. This Feng guy was getting too much right about events that would be embarrassing to the Chi-Coms to be blowing smoke. The PRC hadn't released anything about the subway bombing to the media yet. There was no chatter of it anywhere but for the NSA intercept and Eddie Feng's article. Jack had taken his analysis to John Clark, who'd done some research of his own, before calling Ryan into a meeting with Jerry, who'd okayed a more intrusive operation. Gavin Beery, IT director for Hendley Associates, would pull up Eddie Feng's bank records, phone history, and anything else he could hack into, which was, according to Beery, every digital jot and tittle there was on the man. It turned out Eddie Feng had made a recent payment of $2,000 to a guy named Fernando Perez Gomez, a car dealer in South Dallas who the Texas Department of Public Safety Gang Intelligence Database said had ties to the Tres Equis offshoot of Sinaloa, and a second $2,000 to a Sun Ye On Triad boss, a recent arrival to Plano, Texas, from Taiwan. The information was thin, but considering the underworld players involved and the fact that Eddie Feng had somehow gotten his hands on the information about the Beijing subway bombing, Clark and Hendley had agreed to spool up a short operation and use Eddie Feng as an unwitting agent. Feng would do the hard work, continuing to develop his sources and extracting information from them while they watched from afar and took notes. The campus team would merely follow him during his investigation, see where he went and who he met, and learn if he came up with any more useful intel from behind the bamboo curtain. Beery had located Feng when his phone pinged a cell tower in Houston, but by the time the team had spun up and the Hendley Associates Gulfstream was in the air from Washington Reagan, Feng had already moved north. It didn't take him long, though, to get down to business in the Fort Worth-Dallas Metroplex. In the past 7 hours, the team had followed him to 4 different strip clubs. None of them were particularly high-class joints, but Casita Roja was definitely the worst. What's more, the club was located in an area of town where a couple bearded white guys like Jack Jr. and Midas Jankowski stood out like, well, like bearded white guys in the barrio. Ryan looked at the front door of the club, then back to Midas. They say anything else useful? Not really, Midas said. Other than the meth ingredients, they mostly talked about girls and shit. Adara Sherman, another member of the campus's operational cadre who was conversant in Mandarin, came over the net. One of them has a girlfriend who dances in this hellhole, she said. John Clark spoke next. Did the skinny one mention something about a Camaro? He did, Adara said, obviously impressed. Damn, Ryan said. Am I the only one who's not fluent in a bunch of other languages besides English? Ding Chavez, John Clark, Adara Sherman, and Dominic Caruso all answered back in turn. Si, da, oui, ay. Midas turned and looked at Ryan from the passenger seat, giving a little shrug in the darkness. Yep, he said. Looks like I need Rosetta Stone or a multilingual girlfriend, Jack muttered, reaching over the seat to grab the Gatorade bottle. He started to pop off and say something else, but he caught movement out the rear glass as he turned. He froze. John, he said, you got a visual on our six? I've got movement out our back window. Clark's slightly muffled voice came back a moment later, giving a play-by-play. Ryan could visualize the man's cheek welded to the comb of his suppressed 308 Winchester Model 70, his eye peering through the reticle of a night vision scope. Two Hispanic males, Clark said. One female. Males have pistols tucked in their pants. One is carrying a cane or stick. Scratch that. It's a golf club. The males just left the girl standing at the wall. They're creeping your way, Jack, 10 meters in closing. We're moving in from the west, Chavez said. He was in the crew cab pickup with Adara, a little more than a block away. Dom was parked farther out, 5 blocks up the street in the direction of the next nearest strip club with Hispanic or Asian ties. The location was another educated guess, since Eddie Fung had been working, more or less, along a zigzagging line of such places all day. Stay sharp, Clark hissed. These guys are moving slow, tactical. Always a chance they could be undercover cops. Hang on. The female decided she's coming with them now. From the tone of his voice, it was clear he remained on his rifle. Clark exhaled fast, like a boxer taking a body blow. Shit! Not cops! Guy with the golf club just whipped the shit out of the girl. About time to unass the car partner, Midas said, drawing his sidearm. Hold up, Jack said, his hand on the ignition. I got an idea. They're coming up on either side, Clark said. He could see the man on his side moving up now, almost at the back of the Taurus. Ryan looked across the center console at Midas. Fling your door open on my mark. Midas grinned. I like your style. Ryan turned the key as the image of a man filled his side mirror. He used his left hand to push his door wide open, while at the same moment using his right to throw the Taurus into reverse. The engine roared to life. Tires chattered on the grimy asphalt, and the car shot backward down the alley. The open doors acted like wings, catching the two approaching men, knocking them off their feet and dragging them along with the car. Ryan stomped the brakes just after impact. Physics and inertia kept the doors traveling rearward, slamming them shut and pinching the two men between the unforgiving pieces of steel. Ryan and Midas bolted out of the Taurus on top of their respective assailants. Ryan's was unconscious, but still breathing. The broken shaft of a golf club stuck from his right thigh. Midas's man was a little more coherent, but the retired Delta operator solved that by bouncing the man's head off the doorpost. Ryan and Midas each secured the pistols and did a quick pat-down for other weapons before calling clear. No movement from Casita Roja, Clark said, his voice cool and detached, as if they were still on routine surveillance. Ryan, Midas, pull those guys back behind the sewing machine shop. Ding, you and Adara check on the girl. Gravel crunched as Chavez rolled up with Adara Sherman and loaded an unconscious Asian female into their ratty 4-door Silverado. Adara's sure voice came over the radio. She'd served as a Navy corpsman in a past life and had seen more than her fair share of wounds and death. The girl's still alive, but that asshole broke her nose. Pretty sure her orbital bone is shattered. Good chance she'll have some swelling in her brain. Parkland Hospital is just south of us, Dom Caruso said. It was his job to keep up with things like emergency rooms and police stations during this rolling surveillance. He gave the complete address of Parkland. Roll up to the emergency department, Clark said. Watch for surveillance cameras, but drop her off by the door and haul ass out of there before anyone sees you. They'll be used to it around here. Roger that, Ding said. Adara climbed into the back seat with the unconscious woman and the pickup backed out of the alley, taking a quick but quiet left toward Parkland Hospital. Don't forget to grab her ID, Clark said. He didn't have to say it would come in handy to build their picture of Eddie Fung's web of associates. Way ahead of you, boss, Adara said. No ID, but she does have some kind of brand on the side of her neck. It's covered with blood, but I'll get a photo. Clark came over the net again. You about done, Jack? We could have company any time. Just about, Ryan said. Both he and Midas donned blue nitrile gloves and leaned the unconscious man against the graffiti-covered back wall of the sewing machine shop. Neither man carried ID, which was not surprising. Tattoos identifying them both as Trace Eki's affiliates were clearly visible on their necks and shoulders. Ryan and Midas took the rolls of cash from each man's pocket to make it look like a robbery and jumped back into the Taurus. They'd voucher the money and turn it over to Jerry Hendley, who'd find some charity that needed it. 4.5 minutes after Ryan first saw the men coming up behind them, wind whistled through the bent doorframes as he sped toward Harry Hines Boulevard. I'll be right behind you, Clark said. We'll stay up on the phone and check in tomorrow. This guy has an inside scoop on a terrorist action in the PRC, and now he's involved with drug cartels and the Sun Yeon Triad. Something's going on here, boys and girls. I don't know what it is yet, but it's enough to do some more digging into Eddie Fung. Chapter 2 Captain Leong Tang, a 32-year veteran of China Global Shipping Lines, pressed the small of his weary back against a leaning post on the Bridge of Orion. It was dark outside, but his running lights pushed back the night and illuminated the expansive deck of the great ship. The big low-pressure system whirling up from the southwest had chased Orion across the 124 line and into the mouth of the Strait of Juan de Fuca 2 hours before. The Canadians controlled the separation of shipping traffic up to roughly the 124th meridian of longitude, but when inbound traffic passed Cape Flattery, U.S. Coast Guard vessel traffic services took control. Seattle traffic already knew they were coming, even before they took over from the Canadians. Like every illegal commercial ship on the seas, Orion's automated information system broadcast a unique identifier. Much like an air traffic controller, the vessel traffic coordinator called in periodically to make Orion aware of other commercial vessels, logging tugs, or some other such hazard. Shipping was an around-the-clock business, but Captain Leong could relax and sip his coffee here, even amid the blow outside. Compared to Shanghai, the strait was comparatively dead this time of night. The young woman working VTS was all business, but cordial enough. She understood Leong's English, which many other people didn't, no matter how much he studied. Leong consulted the electronic chart plotter above his console, leaned in to make out the numbers, then nodded to himself. They'd make Eddie's Hook in just over an hour. There they would pick up the pilot who'd drive the ship the rest of the way into the port of Seattle. He took a sip of Sumatran coffee from a ceramic mug that bore the image of a blue and silver Dallas Cowboys football helmet. He was not a fan of the team or the game. He only kept the mug because, though it signified something so uniquely American, it had Made in China etched on the underside. Culturally, Captain Leong should have been drinking tea, but the rigors and travels of a sea captain's life had simply taught him to know better. Chinese tea had a place among women and gentle souls, but sea captains needed coffee, and Captain Leong preferred beans from Sumatra, made even smoother when drunk from his Made in China Dallas Cowboys mug. He'd departed Dalian 15 days before, steaming his way down the eastern coast along the Yellow Sea to make stops in the ports of Tianjin and Qingdao. He topped off his ship at the frenetic port of Shanghai with 6,000 more TEUs, filled with buttons, eyeglasses, smartphones, dinnerware, and countless other shiny trinkets bound for American consumers. There were no doubt a few drugs and an illicit weapon or two hidden in some of the containers, but the captain was a freight man, not a smuggler. Anything illegal on board was the fault of the shipper, not the ship. Captain Leong and his crew of 31 souls, 7 officers and 24 ratings, or able-bodied seamen, had steamed Orion out of the busiest seaport in the world at precisely midnight. Navigating the heavily used sea lanes was made easier for the monstrous ship by a harbor pilot and 2 tugboats. They left under cover of darkness, not because they wanted to hide anything, but because that's when the last TEU was secured to the deck and the final piece of paperwork was signed and stamped by port officials. Captain Leong wanted his ship loading, unloading, or sailing. Anything else was wasted time and money. At 165,000 tons and 50 meters longer than an American Nimitz-class aircraft carrier, Orion required a great deal of space for the basic maneuvers of simply stopping and turning. 2 tugboats worked in concert with the Shanghai pilot on board to assist her in negotiating the crowded waters of the harbor, one ready to bump the side, the other with a steering cable off the ship's stern. They cleared the entrance in less than an hour. The pilot exited through the bunker door below the bridge castle and hopped onto one of the tugs, leaving the huge vessel to her own devices and the crew's good seamanship. Orion's powerful Wärtsilä diesel pushed her northeast on glassy seas at a steady 22 knots. The design of his mammoth container vessel made it impossible for Captain Leong to see the water directly around his ship, but he could imagine Orion's bulbous bow pushing up a frothy white wake on either side. A British sailor would say she'd taken the bone in her teeth. The crew had watched the sparkling lights of Shanghai grow dim and finally wink out behind them, leaving them alone in the purple night. Shortly after sunrise, Orion sailed below the southern Japanese island of Kyushu to catch the dark waters of the Kuroshio Current. Similar to the Gulf Stream of the Atlantic, the Kuroshio flowed up from the equator, pushing her warm waters north and east, and saving Captain Leong and his company precious fuel. The massive ship moved through several squalls as it reached the halfway point of the journey. Then, for the next 3 days, Captain Leong watched the radar above his helm as a giant blob of low pressure brought cooler temperatures and confused seas. Exposed to the westerlies of the open Pacific, the strait offered little protection from the wind and waves. By the time they crossed the 124, gusts were 40 knots and sustained winds had reached 30. Waves were 3 and 4 meters high, but that was okay. Leong's ship was big, and cut through 4-meter waves like they were barely even there. It was too dark to see the shore of Washington's Olympic Peninsula or his starboard side, but he could almost pick up the hint of sawdust and sap from the endless mountain forests. He liked the Pacific Northwest. There was a quietness to the place that calmed him, even in heavy seas. Safely tucked inside the heated bridge, the captain yawned in spite of the nasty blow outside. Any fool could drive a boat on calm waters. It took a real seaman to save fuel in a storm, aboard a box carrying boxes that were filled with boxes. The Yong Tong supposed boys in every country that was bordered by a sea were somehow beckoned by the lure of salt and wind and adventure. But there was no lure in boxes. The captain hardly even noticed them anymore. They were merely gray or blue or red blobs that he looked over and around to try to catch a glimpse of the horizon or the lights of the next port. He had no idea what was in any of the containers. There was, of course, a manifest, but the modern ship's master found himself buried under mountains of paperwork between ports, and Leong simply didn't have the time or the inclination to read it. Dangerous goods were noted, refrigerated containers were stowed together, and unless another dozen Fujianese stowaways had hidden themselves away in one of the TEUs as they had the year before, there shouldn't be anything alive in any of the containers. While the TEU had changed the nature of shipping, progress had changed the inside of the modern seagoing vessel. Orion's helm was not the beefy wooden wheel of Leong's seafaring forefathers, but high-impact plastic, and most of the steering was done through the computer and a small bump lever. A bank of screens above the helm displayed the radar, the EDCIS electronic charts, a depth sounder, radio frequency, a tachometer, and the AIS. This automatic identifications system broadcast the ship's name, speed, and heading to port authorities, passing ships, and if they were savvy enough to have the app for their smartphones, pirates. Fortunately, Seattle had no pirates, but for the company that pumped the shit from the ship's holding tanks, their prices were outrageous. With all the soulless plastic, the only nod toward a more traditional helm was the half-sphere compass, its magnetic correction noted on a metal plate affixed to the plastic beside it. It cost just over one American penny to ship a can of beer across the Pacific, but with that efficiency came the loss of soul. Lightning-quick unloading and loading made it impossible for Leong to give his men liberty in all but a very few ports, and even then, most of them would not be able to make it past the razor-wire fences that cordoned off the MARSEC area of the docks. It seemed to Captain Leong that he'd sailed out of one port when sailing had provided him an exotic life of adventure, and then, over the course of that single voyage, while he was not paying attention, it had become a job. Storms like this at least made him feel like a sailor. And still, the job did have its good points. He did have a few quiet moments to read. The Chinese government frowned on organized religion, but a decade earlier, a zealous dock worker in the Philippines had gifted him a small copy of the King James Bible, and he'd read it many times. Better to dwell in the corner of a roof than in a wide house with a brawling woman, the proverb said. And when Captain Leong thought about his sniping wife, his life at sea seemed less like the corner of a roof than it actually was. Leong heard the squeak of the hatch behind him and turned to see Goose, the Balinese steward, enter with a platter of fresh donuts. At 17, Goose, short for Bagus, meaning handsome in Bali, was by far the youngest pair of hands on the ship. In Leong's estimation, he was also the brightest. "Captain," the boy said in English, giving him a polite nod. "Goose," Leong said, toasting the air with his Dallas Cowboys mug. The boy spoke passable Mandarin, but he was attempting to learn English, the international language of commerce, and it helped Leong and his first officer to try to teach him. It was good practice for the times they needed to communicate via the radio with VTS. Goose held up the donuts. "Mr. Howe, cook donut," he said. "Good English," the captain said. "I like donuts." Goose smiled. "I like donuts." The captain closed his eyes to breathe in the heady smell of the fried dough. He opened his mouth to speak, but was cut off by a loud pop. At first he thought some piece of gear had fallen outside, but a violent shudder ran through the length of the entire ship, as if they'd run aground. Leong's eyes shot open. He set the coffee mug in the slot beside his leaning post and scanned the instruments. The depth sounder showed 119 fathoms, more than 700 feet. Perhaps they'd hit something. Countless TEUs went overboard each year. Most sank shortly after hitting the water, but some lurked just below the surface like drifting reefs. Perhaps Orion had struck one of them, or even a flotilla of logs. Her hull was thick and made to withstand such an impact, but any strike was reason to worry. Half a breath later, a massive explosion rocked the aft decks. The bank of windows along the rear of the bridge castle shattered from the oncoming shockwave. Bits of glass peppered the men like a shotgun blast. Leong grabbed young Goose by the collar and dragged him behind the captain's chair, out of the path of flying debris. First Officer Sue was already there. Outside, heavy containers shot skyward like so many children's toys, disappearing into the darkness to fall into the sea, or crashing back down on the rail to burst and spill their clothing and electronics into the water. Leong couldn't feel the blood from the wounds running down his cheek, but he saw tiny cubes of shatterproof glass embedded in Sue's face. Goose's black hair was covered in the stuff. Windows gone, the gale outside moaned in, whipping through the cabin, lifting papers and ripping away the warmth. The smell of burning plastic and the sharp acidic odor of molten metal flowed in on the back of the wind. The aft deck lights had gone dark, but Leong watched in horror as a pillar of white fire 5 meters wide shot like a geyser from among what was left of the TEUs, illuminating the ship as if it were midday. The captain looked away from the stunning brightness and clapped his hands to clear First Officer Su from his stupor. "Call engineering and get a report," he said. "There will surely be injuries. Goose, get on the intercom and tell Mr. Huang to stand by in the galley." Huang had trained as a medic in the PLA Navy and was the closest thing to a doctor on board the ship. Alarms sounded amid the moaning gale and the shouts of terrified men. Stack after stack of shipping containers listed heavily to starboard. Lashing rods snapped, cracking like gunfire, and the boxes toppled one by one into the angry sea. Wind whipped the heavy black smoke, at once making it easier for Leong to see the carnage and fanning the flames. The white pillar continued to roar upward from the bowels of the ship. Warning lights on the console changed from green to red, flashing urgently as system after system failed. The ship's intercom broke squelch, and the breathless voice of Jimmy, a Filipino deck rating, filled the bridge.
"Captain," the man stammered in English. "I need help, sir."
Goose reached up for the microphone and passed it off to the captain. "Where are you?" Leong asked.
"Engineering."
"I must speak with Mr. Duan." Leong's English was good, but in times like these he preferred to talk to a native of China. Duan was the engineer, the man with the training to understand the questions Leong needed to have answered.
That is not possible," the deck rating said. "Mr. Duan is gone."
"Gone?" Leong whispered. He put a hand on top of his head in dismay. Outside, containers continued to fall over the rails on both sides, and a fearsome groan ran the length of the ship. Leong imagined some awful beast had escaped a TEU and was now running rampant down below. Jimmy grew more breathless with every word, choking back sobs.
I was helping him change a filter. Then it..."
He coughed, probably from smoke.
"There were many explosions from above, and then the most terrible noise. Captain, do you believe in hell?"
"I do not," Leong said, willing himself to remain calm. It did no good to scream at times like this. He prodded the terrified man. "What happened, Jimmy?"
"A ball of white fire. It just dropped."
"Through the ceiling?" Leong said.
"Yes, from above the compartment just aft of the vart."
The rating used the nickname for the engine. "And Mr. Duan?" Leong whispered.
"He fell, sir."
"Fell?" Leong gasped. "He is injured?"
"You do not understand," the rating said. "The fire burned through the deck. Mr. Duan fell into the..."
The man sniffed, obviously trying to compose himself.
"Captain, the deck melted beneath his feet. He is gone."
"Okay," Leong said, trying to imagine the unimaginable scene. "Get out of there."
"I cannot, Captain."
Another gasp turned into a frightened whimper.
"The fire, it was very bright. I saw Mr. Duan fall, but I cannot see anything. The flames are close. I feel the heat. I will fall if I try to move."
"Stay where you are," the captain said. It was no wonder the man was terrified. "I will send someone to collect you."
"Please, hurry."
The line filled with static, then went dead. Leong's head snapped up to look at Sue. The first officer had pulled a thick binder labeled Fire Procedures from below the console and thumbed through it with trembling fingers. "When?" the captain said, calling the addled man by his given name in an effort to steady him. "Put that away and go to engineering. Remind everyone you see to put on their life vests. Some will forget in these moments of confusion." The first officer gave a curt nod, then grabbing his own life jacket from a compartment under the navigation table, ducked his head and moved to the hatch leading to the aft deck. Goose looked back and forth from the open hatch to the captain. "I will go with him," he said, waiting for permission. The captain nodded, picking up the radio phone. "Goose," he said, as the young Balinese steward started down the stairs to the aft passageway. The boy turned, only his head above the deck. "A white flame means a metal fire. Make certain to use the dry Class D extinguishers only. Water will make it worse. And put on a life vest." The boy scrambled back up the stairs to retrieve a life jacket from the locker below the console. A tremendous roar filled the night air. As if to lend credence to the captain's fears, the shriek of rending metal carried in from the aft decks. A shower of white-hot sparks shot skyward out of the gaping hole. The body of a man dressed in flame-retardant coveralls followed, pushed upward on a geyser of steam and flames. Leong watched helplessly as the man fell straight back down into the same fiery pit from which he'd come. Now he believed in hell. He turned to Goose. The boy was paler now, his chin quivering. He'd seen the whole thing. "Go," Leong said, hoping the boy would understand the instructions given in Mandarin. "Keep your—" Something heavy hit him in the head. He saw Goose's terrified face, and then nothing. Goose had watched in horror as the shard of metal from a ripped container whirred in like a saw blade and struck Captain Leong in the back of the head. Goose ducked instinctively, and when he looked up, the poor man was face down in a pool of blood and shattered glass. The boy found himself alone on the bridge. He grabbed the intercom to call for the first officer, but it was dead. The gale moaned outside, rain and wind whipping through the shattered windows. The radio microphone hung from the console on a coiled cord, swaying with the heaving motion of the ship. Goose had been on the bridge during man-overboard drills. He knew how to work the radio, and if there was ever a time to call for help, it was now. What he did not know was how to speak English. He stayed low as he reached for the dangling mic, hiding behind the captain's chair to keep from meeting the same fate. Goose depressed the key on the side of the mic and said the only words he knew that would get help coming his way. "Mayday! Mayday! Man overboard!" A female voice crackled over the radio a moment later. "U.S. Coast Guard, Seattle Sector. Ship calling Mayday. Please say your location." "Yes," Goose said, happy to hear a voice. "Yes! Man overboard! Please to help us!" A horrible clatter rose from the belly of the ship, as if a dragon had gotten loose in the engine room. A moment later, the clatter abated and the steady thrum of the Vart fell silent. Powerless, Orion shuddered and began to turn broadside to the waves, at the mercy of the gale. Out on the demolished deck, rain did little to beat back the wall of fire, now fanned by a wicked wind. Metal groaned and men screamed. The bow began to lift as the aft portion of the ship wallowed lower in the water, flooding compartment by mangled compartment. Goose felt the ship rise under him and huddled among the glass and debris on the floor of the wheelhouse, clutching his knees to his chest and trying to focus on the female voice speaking on the radio. He didn't understand her, but he prayed she was sending help. Chapter 3. The Straits operator, Petty Officer Third Class Barb Pennington, leaned back in the swivel chair, scanning the dotted traffic lanes on the 6-color monitors above her workstation in the Seattle Vessel Traffic Services. It was late, and she'd just taken a sip of coffee when a terrified voice crackled into her headset. She rocked forward immediately, as if getting nearer to her computer screens would help her hear better. Chinese container ship Orion reporting a man overboard, Chief, Petty Officer Pennington said as her supervisor walked up beside her. AIS shows him 2 miles west of Pillar Point. I spoke with a vessel captain at 0114 hours when he crossed the 124 line. It sounds like a different person making the report. I was able to get him to switch to Channel 16, but he's not responding to any other questions.